Third Degree, Climate Justice Radio here on 2SER 107.3 FM. I'm James.
And I'm Libby. And today we're going to be joined by Damien Lawson from Friends of the Earth. But I guess first of all, you're probably wondering what the Third Degree actually is. Well, we're a collective of media students, environmental scientists and climate justice activists who want more meaningful media coverage around issues such as climate change and other environmental issues. And I guess while our government gives the appearance that they are actually finally acting on climate change and enacting serious policy, we sort of want to get around all the rhetoric and greenwashing that gets shoved our way and give the Third Degree to the lies and the unsustainable policies that we're being asked to swallow.
That's right, Libby. The most recent science, in fact, the science for quite some time, tells us that we need to keep global warming far below 2 degrees Celsius. And once we go over 2 degrees, it's a bit of a tipping point, and all sorts of follow-on effects start to happen, and catastrophic climate change engulfs us. However, the federal Labor government's policy is for a 60% reduction of 2000 levels of greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, which, according to the UK's Stern Review, means we're basically going to be in for a 3-degree rise, which is well above the 2-degree level, which the science tells us we should be at. And they're giving us this 3rd degree, knowing full well the consequences will be devastating.
So we're going to be giving the 3rd degree right back to them. And which brings us to the show today, where we're going to be taking a closer look at New South Wales coal mining exploration, as well as at the global food crisis, and also catch up with the My Power cycling tour in the Northern Territory.
But first, today we'll be talking about international carbon trading. The EU's emissions trading scheme has been in place for a number of years now, and one of the biggest criticisms has been the loopholes, which allow for polluters to continue or even increase pollution by what has been described as questionable offsets overseas. And now it seems the Australian government's carbon pollution reduction scheme has the same loopholes open in it. It's the topic of the movie The Carbon Connection, to be screened by Friends of the Earth Sydney next week. We are joined with Damien Lawson, Climate Justice Coordinator from Friends of the Earth. Damien, thanks for joining us.
G'day, James. Libby.
Hello.
Great to be here.
Damien, can you explain to us the basic idea of international carbon trading?
Yeah, it's the global carbon market has sort of developed since the signing of the Kyoto Protocol by many, many countries around the world. And it's essentially the linking of trading schemes like the one that the Rudd Labor government is trying to implement between different countries, and essentially permits to pollute or carbon credits are traded across national borders. Now, the main part of this carbon market, which is quite large, is what's called the Clean Development Mechanism, which was part of the Kyoto Protocol. And essentially it is that projects in developing countries, which supposedly create emission reductions, are then able to be sold to, say, companies in industrialised countries like in Europe. And those companies are able to use those offsets or those carbon credits to offset pollution that they're putting in the atmosphere and actually cut the amount of pollution they're required to reduce under their trading scheme.
Now, you've described the inclusion of international offsets in the carbon pollution reduction scheme is likely to undermine efforts in tackling global warming. Can you explain why you think this will undermine efforts?
Sure. Well, look, the Rudd's government carbon pollution reduction scheme is meant to be about producing 60% cuts in Australia's emissions. But if companies are able to buy these international carbon credits, which are very dubious in character, a lot of the time they're not producing they're not called what's additional, which is making additional reductions on top of what would already be made, then effectively you're actually adding more pollution to the atmosphere. Just let me give you an example. So the Clean Development Mechanism under the Kyoto Protocol, currently it's a major market in carbon credits. There's about 12 billion euros in credits swirling around as part of this market. But most of those emission cuts, about 50% of them over the last 4 years, have come from plants in China which are producing refrigeration pollution. And the companies are making so much money out of receiving these credits. Instead of actually stopping producing their pollution, they're continuing to produce this pollution, then reducing it, and then getting the credit. So there's a lot of problems with corruption and the credibility of the scheme. And once you introduce that into the Australian trading scheme, you're going to actually create an even bigger loophole than some of the loopholes that have been created at the moment.
Yeah, it's pretty ugly stuff. Now, you've raised concerns about the effects that these schemes are having on developing nations, which is detailed in the film The Carbon Connection. We'll give you more information about that film later. Could you explain to us some of the effects carbon trading is having around the world?
Well, one of the whole ideas of originally of offsetting and the clean development mechanism was that these reductions would take place in developing countries and would contribute to sustainable development there. But one of the big problems is that, of course, as is often with many, many development projects around the world, local people aren't consulted. Just to give an example from the film Carbon Connection, you have oil companies and petrochemical companies like BP buying these offset credits so they don't have to reduce their pollution, say, in Scotland, in the UK. The people from Scotland are shown in the film. And they're buying their credits from schemes like the one that's shown in the film in Brazil, where they plant enormous plantations of eucalypts, which aren't native to Brazil, which are having a massive impact on the local water table and affecting communities, farming communities and communities that rely on the local forests there in that Brazilian region. Now, supposedly, the planting of these trees somehow equates with a reduction in emissions from a petrochemical camp plant in Scotland. Now, clearly, that's not the case. And that project is having a big impact on the local people. There's a range of other projects through Africa where sort of rubbish dumps, where they burn off methane, are having a big impact on local people, for example. Big dams that are being built at the moment are applying for carbon credits as well. So what we're saying is emissions should... The best way to reduce emissions is to reduce emissions, not to somehow offset that responsibility onto developing countries.
And you're calling for Australian pollution to be reduced here in Australia. So the main advantage to that will not only be a social advantage, as you pointed out there, but what would the other kind of advantages be?
Well, for a start, it's actually doing what the government has said it wants to do, which is cut Australian emissions. Secondly, it'll be actually more verifiable. I mean, the problem with these offset credits, as we've just talked about, is it's very difficult to verify that you're actually getting a reduction in emissions taking place. You're not going to have the environmental and social impact on people in developing countries from that project. Obviously, there needs to be resources being put into assisting developing countries to reduce their emissions. But part of the problem with secluding and offering these offset schemes, as is the case in the case of making the refrigerant gases, it's actually incentivising countries to not tackle their emissions as a whole, but just have these sort of little side projects where they can actually make money, from getting the credits. I mean, in the case in the refrigeration case in China, then the amount of money that went into those companies was about 4.7 billion euros, where the estimated cost of actually just shutting down those emissions was about 100 million euros.
Oh, wow.
So, that's the sort of thing that needs to happen. There needs to be money perhaps put in from the auctioning of carbon permits in Australia into a fund which helps developing countries reduce emissions and isn't tied into carbon trading.
And if people, I guess, can make a submission to the government regarding the carbon pollution reduction scheme?
That's right. Submissions are still open until September 10. If you go to the government's website, climatechange.gov.au, you can find out how you can make a submission. And I really urge people to make a submission, not just on this issue. I mean, if you do make a submission, say that you want Australian emissions reduced in Australia and that there shouldn't be international linkage, but also that there shouldn't be loopholes for polluters. And that's what big business, particularly the polluting industries, are really putting the pressure on the government at the moment to not auction off permits and to give permits away free under the trading scheme. And look, Kevin Rudd has said he can't even guarantee that the trading scheme will reduce emissions over the next few years. So it's really important people get in there and hear their voices heard.
Yeah, definitely. And that film, The Carbon Connection, will be screening next Tuesday, the 2nd of September, at 6:30 p.m. at Brown Street Community Hall, which is 8 to 10 Brown Street, Newtown. Oh, it's Newtown Library. If you'd like to learn more about international carbon trading or the movie or details on how to send one of those submissions, please visit our website, which is climateradio.blogspot.com. Which brings us to our next segment, which is going to be a regular segment, the burning issue.
Well, in the burning issue, I guess we're going to be discussing some of the most relevant and recent burning issues of the day, issues that are not only burning in our consciousness, but also, I guess, potentially burning up
burning
our climate. Aren't we, Libby?
Yeah, we love the puns.
But today, Libby, we will be talking about continued coal exploration and expansion in the Gunnedah Basin, which is a region of New South Wales, and interestingly enough, also part of the Murray-Darling Basin.
Yeah, that's right. I spoke with Tim Duddy a few weeks ago for 2SER about the blockade that's been happening at his property, where BHP Billiton were wanting to explore for coal, drilling into his land. And yeah, that blockade is still going, contrary to what the media has been telling us, that BHP Billiton aren't going to be continuing to explore in that area. They actually are, as Tim Duddy explains in this next interview.
It's still going, and it's 7 weeks today. BHP have not said they're not going to press forward with exploration. BHP have simply said that they will not mine under the black soil plains with their current technology. That does not mean they never will. That just means they're not going to do it at this moment. They are still intending to gain access to these properties for the purpose of exploration. And after repeated requests to the state government, the federal government, BHP, several other bodies, our fully independent catchment-wide water study has not been commissioned. Until such time as that is done, BHP will be denied access to all rural properties in this district.
Tim Duddy says families from all over the district man the blockade in rostered shifts. But just recently, the Chinese government-owned Shenhua Energy Group has won a $600 million tender to explore for coal in the same region. I asked him whether the community will take on a second mining giant.
That exploration area actually covers the third of our property that BHP does not. I think the district feels exactly the same way towards Shenhua as they do towards BHP, and we are not intending to allow access for the purpose of exploration until such time as our water study is commissioned.
Daddy explains the process of coal exploration used here, and why they are calling for an independent catchment-wide water study to be done.
With the current mining exploration that's going on here, they are not taking any care of the water whatsoever. They go through the first 100 metres of what they class as overburden, which is the area that's very rich in the aquifer structure. They do that drilling in a day. They do the next 300 or 400 metres in a matter of 3 or 4 weeks, taking the core samples for coal. They don't even look at the water they go through to see what the potential damage is. The risks of doing exploration like this without taking into account the water that they go through is huge.
I asked him why he thinks the study has not taken place.
Well, I believe that the reason why it has not been done is a completely reckless abandon by the state government for not taking into account any of the natural resources, such as water or soil, that the state owns. I believe that if they do commission it, there is the potential for it to severely curtail the mining projects that will be able to go ahead here in this district. Without that study being commissioned, should any mining company damage anything like water during the process of exploration, then there's actually nothing to quantify what compensation is due to the people whose livelihoods are destroyed. This is not about a no mine in our backyard. This is about the future of Australian agriculture. This is about the water supply of 5 or 6 towns, maybe more. The implications of this mine going ahead without study, with just a hole in the dark, is enormous.
And that was Jess Minchell talking to Tim Duddy about the blockade that's happening on his property in the Gunnedah area.
Against, and also the expansion of exploration from China.
Yeah,
yeah,
which is happening across the Liverpool Plains, which is about 35k southeast of Gunnedah. So, yeah, that's obviously the area to be at if you're a coal person. and I guess, yeah, so we're having a bit of a chat about this as our burning issue of the week. And I guess, yeah, the main thing is that it is coal again, just getting in the way of things. I think it's really time for the government to be phasing out coal rather than launching into a massive deal of this kind. It's incredibly destructive to the environment, incredibly polluting. You know, it's causing massive damage via climate change, let alone the damage that individual mining does to land. So, it's an ugly thing to be doing this, continuing to invest in this, when there are so many viable alternatives.
It seems very strange, because we were just talking about, you know, the carbon pollution reduction scheme, and Damien, this seems to be something which is sort of at opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, expansion of coal whilst we're trying to reduce.
Yeah, we're trying to reduce.
Yeah, it's amazing the power the coal industry has in Australia. I mean, part of the whole reason why the carbon reduction pollution scheme is going off the rails already is because of the coal lobby, and they're very powerful. I mean, it's Australia's biggest export, and Australia's the biggest coal exporter in the world, and it's really inspiring for me, I think, to see that here's, you know, a group of farmers who aren't normally seen as the most sort of radical people in Australia are taking direct action, just in the same way, you know, 1,000 people took direct action in Newcastle, the world's biggest coal board, a few weeks ago. So that's really exciting. There's no solution to climate change unless we deal with coal. Half the fossil fuel pollution in the air has come from burning coal over the last few hundred years. So stopping coal being dug up and burnt is the key solution to climate change, I think. And it's great what these guys are doing out in the Gunda.
Yeah, it is wonderful to see that community taking action, and I guess it does sort of highlight that it's, you know, this could be coming up a bit more, that it could be a bit of an issue of agriculture or food versus coal and power when they're wanting to use land that's traditionally been used for agriculture to dig into that for coal exploration.
Yeah, well, Nikki Williams, the CEO of the Minerals Council, was quoted in the Northern Daily Leader last week saying that mining and other land uses happily coexist. But I'm not sure if I've ever seen, you know, a farm in an open pit coal mine before, or I don't know. I mean, you look at the Hunter Valley, it's not exactly a community which is, you know, overly integrated. There's a lot of problems around there.
Yeah, and I guess what's concerning the farmers in Caruna is that, you know, this is prime, really fertile agriculture area, and they're really, really worried that not only is the mining sort of, you know, taking place a bit where they've traditionally farmed, but also that, you know, it's actually going to destroy that land so that they won't ever be able to farm there again, because they're worried about what coal mining and even just drilling for coal exploration does to the aquifers and the water resources in the area.
And, I mean, even, you know, in spite of the, you know, whatever damage they can do, the amount of water coal mines use you know, what the community gets back at the moment doesn't seem to really compensate for what's going to be taken away.
Yeah, there's all these sort of, I don't know, token things that they're getting out of the huge amounts of money that Shenhua is paying to explore there.
It's a crazy cycle when you think about it, because you dig up the coal and you burn it, and you produce this climate-induced drought, which is affecting, you know, 70% of New South Wales farming land. And then you do it in some of the prime farming land where agriculture is still going on at the moment and is managing to happen, even though we've got this drought. So as climate change reduces the amount of land we can graze on and have agriculture on, you're whacking your big coal mines in the middle of it and destroying them as well. It's a crazy cycle.
They mentioned the, I guess, the global food crisis in there partly, and the world shortages of food happening around the world. The cost of staple foods have risen by an estimated 83% over the past 3 years. There are many factors which are contributing to the price surge. These include financial speculation, the use of grain for biofuels, and the rising demand for food combined with declining agricultural yields, and no doubt related to many droughts happening around the world. The Third Degree's Nick Collins spoke with Julian Cribb, Adjunct Professor of Science Communication at UTS.
The world is currently at its lowest level of food security in 50 years. That is that we now have less food available per head than we've had at any time in that past period, and that every year we are actually consuming slightly more food than we are producing. So we're going backwards. Behind that is a multitude of factors. The world is running out of water. A lot of water is being diverted to the cities, and obviously there's climate change and other things that are coming into the picture. We're running out of land, enormous quantities of land. A quarter of the world's agricultural area is degraded. And at the same time, cities and recreational uses are taking over much of our land area. Fertilizers have suddenly got very expensive, driven by oil prices, which means that poor farmers can't afford to use fertilizers to lift crop yields. And so crop yields are starting to go backwards in a great many countries now. And for similar reasons, the amount of effort that's being put into agricultural research is no longer there compared with 10 or 20 years ago. So there's less new technology coming along to help farmers raise their yields. So there are all sorts of pressures starting to be felt, and they're all coming out as periodic shortages of food. And biofuels is one of those factors. It is possible that biofuels is driving up the cost of fuel. The World Bank, in fact, attributed 75% of the current rise in food prices to biofuels, but I think personally that that's an overestimate.
What actions would you like to see Australia and the Australian government take in relation to agriculture?
Well, first of all, we should remember that Australia was one of the countries that helped build the Green Revolution back in the 1960s and 70s, and we have forgotten that. So the first thing is I would like to see us double the amount of scientific effort we're putting into sustainable agricultural systems, both for our own country, and heaven knows the Murray-Darling Basin desperately needs some sustainable agricultural systems. It hasn't got any at the moment. And also for overseas countries which are in a similar plight, very short of water, very fast-growing populations, not enough land or food production. So I think primarily Australian governments have got to focus on what is the most important thing for human survival, and that is having enough food, sufficiency of food produced year in, year out, no matter what happens, and that's sustainability. So to secure both our own food future and also to secure that of our neighbours so that they won't have wars and drag us in, we need to really focus on developing the technologies that enable us to do that.
How might green cities contribute to what you've called a sustainable food revolution?
Yeah, well, once upon a time, quite a lot of food was produced in cities, but now almost none is. Cities are enormous traps for water and nutrients. Nutrients flow into cities from all over the landscape and all over the world, and then they get put in the sewage farm and flushed out to sea, which is a terrible waste because these things are very, very precious. So cities, if cities are collecting all this water and they're collecting all these nutrients, then they should be turning some of it back into food. So I would like to see urban food production, which is crops grown on the roofs and the walls of buildings, using stormwater, using recycled and cleansed effluent and things like that. We could produce an awful lot of food in our cities if we really wanted to. And fortunately, we're starting to see some architects who are waking up to this fact, and they're designing cities that will do that.
And now, from green cities to green schools. My Power is one of many groups cycling around Australia at the moment to promote sustainability. They're in the Northern Territory at the moment, and Third Degree's Andy Small caught up with Marikai from the My Power team after their visit to Mataronka Primary School.
Some people think we're in it for the bike ride, some people think we're in it to help Australia become more sustainable, but we're really in it for both.
Since December last year, four guys from Sydney, calling themselves the My Power Team, have been biking their way clockwise around the edge of Australia. During the journey, they've been promoting sustainable living and educating themselves on how people are changing their lifestyles to match the environment. One of their most recent stops was Mataronka Primary School, just outside Katherine, a school where staff and students are putting sustainable living into practice. I caught up with Marikai from the My Power team this week while they were taking a break in Tennant Creek, and we talked a bit about some of the sustainable initiatives at Mataronka Primary.
And Mataronka was a real eye-opener for us. It's a primary school, but the school acts sustainably and doesn't just talk about being sustainable. And when you go to the school, it's incredible what these young year one to year six kids are doing. They've got, in the back of the school grounds, they've got a really diverse agroforestry plot. each of the kids administers to his or her own tree, and they help it grow up tall and straight, and eventually the timber from these trees, if they grow the right way, is saleable at $1,500, which goes straight back into the school.
And did you learn about any other programs while you were there?
There's a lot of things the school's doing. I'll just talk about the school grounds firstly. They've also got a bush foods program, which is really important to us because we're trying to direct people to rediscover native foods. And there's a whole lot of northern figs in that they're growing. And they also have an orchard, and the school's registered as a food business. So the Year 6 kids actually go and harvest the food on site and then cook that for the younger kids at the school. They're also trying to start up a solar program and solarise the whole school, which we're trying to help them do with one of our sponsors. It's just endless, the things that these young kids are trying to attempt at the school. It's impressive.
And did you get the impression that the kids have taken to these sustainable initiatives with enthusiasm?
Oh, absolutely. What they're working for is a good thing, and they know it, and they're so excited about it. In my eyes, they're a perfect example of a primary school, and one that I would have loved to have gone to if I was a kid.
I'm also interested to know how have locals been receiving you as you cycle through some of the more outlying towns in Australia?
We're received really well, and I think it comes back to the fact that there is no good argument against sustainable living. So when you say that's what you're doing, you're encouraging actions like planting trees, using less energy, saving water. So we're received quite well by the travellers and the locals alike. And in remote areas, they're really halfway to living really sustainably anyway as a necessity. You know, there's not much water going around and electricity generation's far away.
And have you crossed paths with any other long-distance cyclists during your trip?
There's people doing crazy things, and we've bumped into a few. A lot of them are from Holland.
Wow.
There's a lot of crazy Dutch cyclists. One bloke we met had done 56,000 kilometres, and he was planning to go from the tip of Patagonia up to Alaska,
oh, wow,
which I think's 30,000. And we were we're not cyclists, you know, and so we were real proud of what we'd done so far. And he looked at us and he just said, but Australia is just a small island.
And that was Andy Small speaking with Marikai from the Maya Power team. And you're listening to the Third Degree Climate Justice Radio on 2SER 107.3 FM.
And so I guess that brings us to sort of the end of this week's, our very first show of the Third Degree on 2SER.
Be sure to visit our website, climateradio.blogspot.com. And if you have any feedback about today's show, or if you have any requests for stories or ideas or interviews or any comments at all, give us an email, climateradio@gmail.com.
Yep, and next week, Jess and Nick will be here, and they'll be speaking to Erland Howden from the Nature Conservation Council about the evils and perils of flying.
Well, that's all from us this week. Damien, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thanks a lot for having me.